Welcome back to the show. This is Cindy Sheehan Soapbox at cindysheehansoapbox.com. Thank you, as always, for listening. We have a really good show today, as we usually do, so we're going to get right into it. Please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this break.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
This is Jamie Romano of James Communications. We are living in such exciting times. Never before in history has the global community come together in solidarity as we are now. Wonderful work is being done locally, nationally, and globally on every human and environmental issue that needs to be addressed. I developed James Communications to help you maximize your contribution to the world. Whether you're a small group, a large organization, or an individual with an altruistic dream, if you're working in service to humanity or the planet, James Communications will work with you to streamline efficiency and strengthen the impact of your cause or campaign. For more information on how James Communications can help you do what you do, please visit www.jamescommunications.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at cindysheehansoapbox.com. My guest today is Kevin Zeese, Z-E-E-S-E. Kevin is a longtime friend of mine and also a political, social, and environmental activist. Kevin is the executive director of Voters for Peace. Welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, Kevin.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, it's nice to have you on. I've been wanting to get you on the show, and I think that this is a perfect opportunity because I know you're working on two very important issues for the country. But before we get into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about last week, what happened in the Bush administration. I'm sorry. I always do that. What happened in the...
Oh, now, Cindy, I can't imagine that you would mix the two up.
Well, you know, eight years plus of the same stuff, and I'm always doing that now. So
they're so different.
But anyway, last week in the Obama administration, we saw a lot of flip-flopping going on, and it's amazing to me that he is responding not to pressure from the left, but pressure from the right. You know, as far as the torture photos, he replaced General McKiernan with General McChrystal in Afghanistan. What else happened last week?
Well, those two really got me. Those are two big ones.
Oh, military commissions also.
He reinstated military commissions. That's right.
What do you think about his response to the right and caving in to pressure from the right?
Well, I think that, it shows that the left needs to get better organized and be more aggressive and withhold their votes from people who promise more war. We can't just vote for someone who, you know, promises to, as he did during the campaign, expand Afghanistan, attack Pakistan very slowly and incompletely, withdraw from Iraq, and hope that someone who says that is going to actually support our cause when he's obviously saying he doesn't. We have to use our vote to stop that. These three things in particular were, I think, very important because they put Obama on the side of the torturers and war criminals. He's essentially hiding evidence of war crimes, hiding evidence of torture by not allowing those pictures to be released and those videos to be released, even though the courts have ordered them released. And I say that's important evidence because what those pictures and videos show is that this is not just a few bad apples. This was a policy of torture and abuse of prisoners, a policy. We're talking about 20,000 pictures here and videos, and this is widespread. This is not just a few people doing some crazy stuff in Abu Ghraib. This is probably in numerous prisons across Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not surprising. Human Rights Watch reported that 98 people died in detention in Iraq and Afghanistan in U.S. prisons, and so we're obviously doing a great deal of harsh treatment. The appointment of McChrystal is the same type of thing. McChrystal is a guy who Cy Hirsch accuses of running an assassination squad. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who was commander of Court Nama and of the special forces that were involved in torture. In fact, two prisoners, I don't call them detainees like the United States government does. These are prisoners who are held, they're not stopped and checked, you know, like a detainee, do you have any weapons on you? They're held in prison for months or years. And two died under the command, the people that McChrystal was commanding. Five officers were convicted of abuse of prisoners. McChrystal reportedly was protecting this abusive activity and had as their slogan of this command, if they don't bleed, they can't prosecute for it. We're putting this guy in charge of Afghanistan?
Well, not only that, he was also very instrumental in covering up, not just covering up, but lying about Tillman's death.
Good point.
Yeah, and many people have called him Cheney's general. And with Dick Cheney going around the TV every day, I was I watched a little piece from Saturday Night Live. It was Will Ferrell doing George Bush, and I think Daryl Hammond doing Dick Cheney. And George Bush says to Dick Cheney, "So you've been on TV lately?" And Dick goes, "Yeah, I've done a little bit of TV." And George Bush goes, "A little bit? You've been on more than the ShamWow guy." And so what to me it looks like is the Obama administration is essentially being pressured and caving into the pressure from Dick Cheney with not releasing the torture photos, putting Dick Cheney's general in charge of Afghanistan, and re-instituting the military commissions.
Yeah, and Cheney, to me, looks like a criminal returning to the scene of the crime. He's returning to make sure all the evidence is hidden and that his fingerprints aren't anywhere and that, you know, they don't go after him. And he's just putting up as many walls as he can to any kind of accountability for those responsible for war crimes. And Obama is helping him, sadly.
Well, it's amazing to me that he can actually go on TV and admit or confess to these war crimes. And, you know, I've just, you know, really crossed that third rail and said that Obama doing this and killing innocent Afghans and Pakistanis and covering up torture and covering up the war crimes of the Bush administration, that makes him a war criminal too.
It's funny you say that. I was just, before you called, talking to Ralph Nader, mm-hmm. and Ralph says Obama is a war criminal. And for exactly the same reasons you just laid out, he's killing civilians, wedding party bombings, drones killing 70 civilians for every one fighter. And so I think more and more people are seeing that Obama is part of this. The Progressive magazine had an article about how he's an accessory after the fact to war crimes. And so I think we're seeing this more widely. I think those who follow the Iraq war, Guantanamo, torture issues, the military commissions are seeing that Obama is behaving very much like Bush.
Well, you know me. I've never been one to say, let's give him a chance. And I was asked the other day when I thought the occupations and the consequences become his problems, or when did they become his problems, or when will they become his problems? And I said they became his problems January 20th, 2009. I mean, in 2009, because that's when he was inaugurated, and that's when he took over responsibility for this as a so-called commander-in-chief. Some people would argue he's not technically a commander-in-chief because these wars were never constitutionally declared, but so-called, he became Commander-in-Chief on January 20th, 2009. What do you think, Kevin? I know you're a real smart political analyst. And what do you think about the whole Pelosi drama that seems to be growing? When did she know about torture? Did the CIA lie to her? And I sent out something yesterday, say something like, is Nancy Pelosi a liar, a coward, or just plain old stupid? And you sent me just one short reply, all of the above. What do you think about that, about what's going on? Why is it going on, and her response to it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Let's put aside the question of lying, because I don't think we're ever going to know what was actually said in those meetings. You know, they're going to say one thing, she's going to say another thing,
right.
And we probably will never know who's telling the truth.
And right, so, and surprisingly, Democrats are backing her up, and Republicans
are not
disagreeing
exactly.
with her. So right, we'll never know the truth.
So let's put that aside. Let's just take her at her word. They only told her about the torture practices they were going to use. To me, that's enough right
mm-hmm,
there.
Mm-hmm.
She needs to be speaking up right then.
Me too.
And, you know, I know they have this secrecy of national intelligence matters, but there are things that come before that. And the thing that comes before that is preventing war crimes and preventing the U.S. from becoming a torturer state and from preventing the U.S. going to war based on false information achieved by torture. And, you know, so I think Pelosi missed her opportunity there to show some ethics and speak up against torture right then. It was a good opportunity to do so. And she could have done it in ways that even mentioned this was told to her in a briefing. She could have spoken about this in ways that brought it up without even mentioning that, but saying that torture would not be acceptable in any Congress that she's in, that she'll fight it. And she could have done that, but she didn't. She remained silent, and therefore she becomes complicit. Now, the interesting thing that I think that's happening that might be helpful to all of us is that Pelosi is calling for a full accounting. Well, hey, I'm all for full accounting. Let's start the torture hearings. Let's start the torture commission. Let's find out what really happened on that front. And, you know, with the Republicans pushing for more information and Pelosi pushing more information, maybe we can actually have it. But, of course, I remember, and I think you and I were arrested, in fact, around this issue of impeachment
right.
In John Conyers' office.
Right.
He was stopped
Absolutely.
by Pelosi.
Right.
From pursuing impeachment. You know, when he ran for re-election in 2006, when the Congress ran for re-election, the Democrats sought to take control of Congress in 2006, Conyers was promising, he put out a report, multi-volume report about the, you know, crimes of the Bush administration and how he should be impeached for them. But, you know, by the time the election happened, he was not doing anything. He was totally stopped, and he blamed Pelosi for it. So we'll see if Pelosi really means that she wants an investigation. I think we should take her at her word, so to speak,
yeah.
and push for it and use her words to do so. And as Speaker of the House, she could help make that happen, and we should hold her accountable and make it happen. Let's see that kind of commission, examining the roots and the extent of this war crime and torture policy.
Well, and John Conyers, before he became the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which was something that was very important to him, he promised me personally that he would impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. That's why I never gave up on him. That's why I always pressed him and pressed him and pressed him for it. What we have to do on the grassroots, I think, and realize is that, like you said, if the CIA's lying or if Pelosi's lying, it's the CIA and she's a politician, and that's what they do. You know, that's what those two institutions do, and it has to be, like you said, up to we the people to press for integrity. You are the executive director of Voters for Peace. It's an organization that I'm on the board, and we encourage people to go and take the pledge to only vote for candidates who promise to end the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, who promise not to get us into any more foreign wars of aggression based on lies and for profit. And that's, you know, I always give my listeners a soapbox action to do every week. So can you give them that website so they can go and take the Voters for Peace pledge?
Yeah, that'd be great. If they come to votersforpeace.us, they can do a couple things. The easy one, of course, is to pledge, to use your vote to support candidates who oppose future wars of aggression and also want to see these occupations end. So that's an easy one to do. The second thing we have on the website, of course, is around the whole torture issue. We have several actions to take on that, calling for a special prosecutor, calling for a commission, and urging the Department of Justice to disbar the lawyers who work for the Department of Justice who facilitated torture. So, and it, all that stuff, you could do all that stuff together in less than 5 minutes. So it's not a big ask. It's actually a relatively easy ask, but it will make a difference. And once you make that, take those steps, you'll be on our list to get updates about how we progress on those fronts. We're also, in addition to fighting those issues, we've been regularly out there pushing the question of the economic impact of the war, and stopping the funding of the war and cutting the Department of Defense's budget. So we're in this critical time of economic collapse. I think it's really important for us to start to put forward the economic impact of the gigantic military budget that is 50% of discretionary spending. One reason why we are in such trouble economically is because we have been investing for years, in fact for decades, too much in the military, right, and not enough in the civilian economy.
Right.
We're pushing on all those fronts. So, but take these initial steps. Fight on the torture issue and pledge to vote peace. And you do those two things, just by going to votersforpeace.us.
Well, I do want to talk about the push to disbar the 12 attorneys. I heard that on CNN of this coalition that was pressing for that. And it was just a real quick little blurb about it. It wasn't anything big. But another thing, I know that you're very interested in the environment, and you're an environmental activist also, among other things. What do you think about the Environmental Protection Agency just approving 42 more West Virginian mountaintops to be blown off to extract coal for the so-called clean coal that President Obama pushes for?
I'll tell you, that mountaintop removal just pierces me, through my body. I mean, we've already pulled the mountaintops off of literally hundreds,
right,
of mountains in that Appalachian area. These are already, areas that are challenged environmentally by coal, and we don't need it. I mean, we should be building a carbon-free, nuclear-free energy economy. If Obama were to commit to a carbon-free nuclear energy economy by 2030, he could achieve it and dramatically change our economy and energy and environment in all positive ways. And so I think he's missing a tremendous opportunity. I think he's paying back, the coal industry that,
right,
was a big supporter of his,
right,
when he was in the Senate. The southern part of Illinois is a big coal area. And so he's doing payback, allow for this phony clean coal, which doesn't exist. And if you start with the idea of mountaintop removal and the sludge and the backup and all the mess that causes,
right,
how can you call anything that comes out of that clean?
Well, it's like Robert Kennedy Jr. says, he says that clean coal is a dirty lie. There's a commercial that plays here in San Francisco. I don't know if it plays in other places. It's a coal industry showing President Obama in one of his speeches saying that we will, reduce our dependence on foreign fossil fuels by utilizing clean coal. But at what expense of,
yeah,
destroying the environment here in America. I was driving over here today, and I hear on the CNN radio news about Obama's big plan to increase fuel efficiency by 2016, but not one mention of this destruction of the Appalachians, of more leases than the Bush administration granted.
And if you look at Obama's energy budget, it's basically a blueprint, a copy of the Bush energy budget. A lot of money for oil, coal, nuclear, and just tiny amounts of money for the real solutions that are ahead for us, which are solar, wind, and geothermal, and almost no money for that area. So he's talking one thing, he's singing lullabies in his beautiful speeches, but when you get down to where the money's going, what the policies are, on the domestic front as well, this is so Bush-like. It's just incredible. This guy is getting away with this, and people are falling for it.
Well, it's just You know, I think that that's that's what the system counts on, is like every 4 to 8 years you switch parties of the person who sits in the White House, and the one half of the country that was screaming against the policies of President A, as soon as, you know, President B from the other party comes in, they start, you know, being co-opted by the system and believing in the system because President B happens to be a member of their party. And that's what keeps us in this, you know, turmoil every 4 to 8 years. For the last 8 years, people were screaming against these kinds of things, against military commissions, against torture, against Iraq and Afghanistan, against mountaintop removal. But now that Obama's doing it, they're not. And you think, or do you think the Republicans are going to scream about those things? No, they're actually congratulating President Obama on his policies.
Exactly. They're applauding him. Cheney even is applauding him on some of these issues. I mean, Obama is doing the work of the to protect Bush and Cheney from being held accountable, from protecting their understaff from being held accountable, and now he's protecting the industries that supported the Bush-Cheney administration, because they also support the Obama-Biden administration. They are basically the same funding base that got them into office, also got Obama into office. It's a pitiful reality of our phony democracy. And you and I both run for office, and we know the roadblocks that are put up to running for office, a combination of corporate media, corporate cash, and, you know, debate rules.
Absolutely.
I mean, they do their best to shut out any, and I don't care whether you're running as a third party or you're running as an insurgent within the Democratic Party. They'll do the same thing to both. They will stop you in your tracks if you're going to challenge corporate power. And that's what this all comes down to on almost every one of these issues. You see the same foundational problem, which is corporate control of government. And you see it in there. You go to opensecrets.org, and you can see their funding sources.
Absolutely.
And there's no way to avoid that reality. Thankfully, more and more Americans are waking up to that and realizing it. Shows like yours, creating our own media, is so important. The web is critically important. People are getting information in our email boxes that every day that it would take a lifetime for us to get in previous generations before us. Now we get that information every day, and I think people are waking up much more quickly than the politicians realize. And we don't know what's going to spark it, but a populist revolt is on the edge, and I think that's the thing that scares Obama, Biden, Reid, and Pelosi more than anything else, is a populist economic revolt, and it's on the edge of happening.
Well, it scares the establishment, right? And Obama is just a tool of the establishment.
Exactly.
So we have to take a quick break right now, Kevin.
All right.
You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. We're talking to political activist Kevin Zeese. We'll be right back after this short break.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I want to continue this fascinating conversation with my friend Kevin Zeese. And Kevin, you mentioned that you ran for political office. You ran for Senate in Maryland, didn't you?
That's right.
And you ran on a coalition of parties.
Yeah, well, I tried to. I was nominated by three parties, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, and the Populist Party. And that was the first time ever that the Greens and Libertarians nominated the same candidate. And as the campaign started and those nominations came in, there was a emergency legislation passed in the Maryland legislature, and that's usually used for, like, floods and hurricanes and, you know, emergency relief. But they passed emergency legislation to make it clear that I could only have one party nomination and be listed. So I was a Green in the end, but I was nominated by three parties.
And I get a lot of support from libertarians, especially young people who are on the Ron Paul revolution, and
right.
and a lot of people in the pretend left, you know, who are really just Democrats. They call you know, people who support Ron Paul really despicable names that I don't want to say over the air. And there's many things that you and I would disagree with Ron Paul, but first of all, he was able to energize young people in an incredible movement, and mostly around economics and foreign policy, I think.
Well, I think it's, you know, the Ron Paul move is a very interesting one. I think one of the things that was really interesting in the campaign this year was when Ron Paul, Cynthia McKinney, Ralph Nader, and the Constitution Party candidate
Chuck
Baldwin,
yeah.
All joined together, and the Libertarian also agreed, but he didn't show up at the meeting. But so you had the four third-party candidates, an independent, along with Ron Paul, and they had four principles they put forward on the Constitution, on debt, on the wars, and they found areas of agreement. Now, there are definitely areas where I disagree with libertarians. You know, when I ran for libertarian to get their nomination, I had to go in front of the Libertarian State Party chair committee.
Right.
So it was the top libertarians in the state, and the first question they asked me was, "You favor socialized medicine. How can you be a libertarian?" Because I do favor a single payer health care plan, which
right.
is not socialized medicine, but some people describe it that way.
Right.
And I was able to answer that question, describing how actually single payer provides more freedom for people because we're not limited by insurance company doctor lists or insurance company hospital lists or HMO treatment plans. We actually get to choose which doctor and hospital and plan we want to go to, and not controlled by these corporations that say, no, you can't use that doctor. And I also talked about how businesses would be freed up, how employees could leave their job and keep their health care, change jobs without fear. So it increases freedom for businesses, increases freedoms for people, and actually reduces the deficit for the federal and local governments. And so I ended up getting the Libertarian nomination. I needed two-thirds support. I got one vote more than I needed to get that nomination. So even libertarians were willing to support me as a single-payer advocate.
Well, I don't think that we're going to effectively be able to challenge the establishment, what I call the robber class, politically until our third-party or independent movements do get together like that and agree on just central issues and work together to challenge the establishment. I think the establishment wants us to be politically divided in the robbed class, so we can't mount credible challenges to them. So let's talk about single payer since you brought it up. You're also involved in a single payer healthcare movement, and were you arrested in the Baucus? You were one of the Baucus 8 or the Baucus 5?
I was number 7.
Okay.
of the first 8. Yeah.
You know, and that's something also that the supporters of Obama tend to ignore, is that he is blocking, you know, to having even a single payer advocate in on the discussions. And pretty much, I think what's coming out of his administration is that there won't be single payer, that it's dead, and any reform has to include the HMOs, the healthcare companies, and big pharma.
Exactly. And so when I testified from the audience in front of the Finance Committee, my testimony was that this committee had taken millions of dollars from the pharmaceutical, HMO, and insurance industries just in the last election, that the chairman had taken millions of dollars from those industries over his career, and that they were putting those industries' profits ahead of the basic necessities of the American people, and excluding the most most popular reform, single payer, which is supported by 60% of the American public, by 60% of doctors, by majorities of nurses, by majorities of economists. It's the most popular, cost-effective way to cover every American, and it's not even being discussed. And the reason they won't let it at the table is because if you get down to a factual discussion comparing the alternatives, single payer wins on every count, and especially on financing. And what they're talking about now instead about financing is taxing health benefits as income.
What?
I mean, that is so obscene.
What?
To tax health benefits as income is to me an obscenity that should create that kind of populist revolt that we're talking about. They're also talking about forcing you to buy insurance.
Right.
So you'll be forced to buy insurance, make the insurance company wealthy.
Right.
You're going to have your benefits taxed, so you are paying a big tax increase, and there'll be no guarantee that you get covered. And all this mess we currently have of 31% of our health care bill going to bureaucracy created by the insurance industry is going to remain. And this phony idea of a public option is a failure. We're being fooled and bamboozled by that. The public option won't work for three reasons. One, it's going to continue all the bureaucracy we currently have, so 31% of the waste will continue.
What's the public option?
It's the idea is that they're going to create a public insurance so people can choose that over the private insurance. And that's being fought. Howard Dean's pushing that. Obama's pushing that. But it's a phony thing because it doesn't deal with the bureaucracy. Secondly, what will happen will be the insurance companies will raise the rates on the chronically ill and the high-risk patients, and so they'll be forced into the public insurance. So the public insurance will have the most expensive consumers and have a hard time paying those bills. And the third thing that will happen will be the insurance companies will say, we can't compete with the government. You can't subsidize insurance. Make them pay their own way, and they'll cut the budget, the funding for the public option. So it'll be an underfunded program with the most expensive patients to be responsible for. And so down the road, the insurance companies will say, look, we're making big profits. We're running the insurance fine. But look at the government. It can't run the insurance. It's losing money. It's costing us money. We can't do a government-run program. It'll be a ripoff and a bamboozlement of the people. And we have to be saying no to any health insurance-based reform. We need instead to reform health care and get rid of the health insurance industry and replace it with a single payer so we have real choice of any doctor we want, any hospital we want, any health plan we want, not choice controlled by the corporations.
Well, then people always, like you said, they always will say, well, that's going to limit our freedom. It's going to limit our access to health care. But that's also, like you pointed out with the Libertarian Party, a very false.
It's the opposite.
Right.
It's the exact opposite.
Well, look at Canadian health care.
Exactly. And, Canadian health care, for example, the doctor fills out a postcard and gets reimbursed for the visit. In the United States, 20% of a doctor's overhead is spent on dealing with insurance companies. In hospitals in the United States, you have one insurance administrator to deal with billing for each bed in the hospital. The Massachusetts spend as much on administration as all of Canada combined. And then we see healthcare as a central plank of a prosperity agenda. In fact, in addition to our anti-war project, we have a project called prosperityagenda.us. And that's a place people who are interested in economic issues can go. There's a whole range of economic issues from employee ownership of business to health care for all to turning corporate welfare into an equity investment where taxpayers get to own a part of the company, dealing with climate change so that the carbon tax reduces the tax burden on the working class, taxing the Wall Street investments, which currently go untaxed. While we pay a tax on food, clothing, and shelter, investments on Wall Street, there's no sales tax. I mean, so it's totally, the robber class is winning there as well. So we have a whole agenda. We see healthcare as a central plank of that economic agenda. So if people want to get involved in that and develop a strategy and make a new economy, go to prosperityagenda.us and get involved in that economic effort.
Oh, we have all kinds of listener soapbox actions to do today. Tell us about what happened in the Baucus hearing. What I saw, the things that I've seen since those arrests was that Senator Baucus and Senator Kerry especially were mocking the people who were being arrested or who were there trying to voice their First Amendment right to free speech, but also to be heard by the government, to have a voice at the table. And like you said, we've been arrested before, you know, various things through Washington, D.C., trying to do this also. But I was listening to Ed Schultz.
That is great.
Yeah, he's good on this issue for sure, on health care for sure, on single payer. But when he said, oh, and those people that got arrested were, you know, they were doctors and nurses, they weren't psycho activists.
Yeah, they weren't code pink.
Yeah.
So
what are we saying that only, you know, people who have credentials are supposed to be able to express their opinions there? But just seeing Senator Kerry and Max Baucus, like, mocking the people was disgusting.
What I saw in the committee was fear. I saw Grassley leaning over to Baucus, kind of trying to coach him. I saw Kerry nervously saying stupid things. I saw Baucus saying stupid things like one person says we need single payer health care, and Baucus says we need more police. I mean, you know, they really looked nervous and like things were falling apart. And I really think they're a lot less secure than they seem. And, you know, our demonstration where we had 8 people stand up, each one in a row making different points, I think was very powerful. But the next week there was another powerful demonstration, and there were 30 nurses who stood up when Baucus started speaking, and they were wearing their nurse scrubs. They turned their back on him, and they had a sign on their back favoring single payer and opposing a health insurance-based reform. And that, of course, was the cameras could take that picture because they were also in that direction. And then they all walked out, and the room applauded as they walked out. After they were done, then 5 people stood up individually, 3 members of the Physicians for National Health Program, which is a great group working on this, 2 members of the California Nurses Association, which is another great group working on this. They are the best, by the way. The California Nurses Association are fantastic.
No, they rock.
They rock. They're great. And they stood up all like we did the week before, making their point. And very powerful demonstrations. And it just shows their insecurity that they won't allow us to be part of the discussion. They know that we win the arguments. They know that we are the only way you can afford to provide health care for all. But on the other hand, they also know that we will undercut the robber class, as you call them, the insurance industry, the HMOs, and the pharmaceutical companies, because those industries will either be put out of business or their profits will be dampened because you have one single payer negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry for fair prices. And that will change the whole dynamic.
Oh, absolutely. And this issue also, a lot of people think that single payer is now dead, that there's too much obstacle and, you know, obstacles thrown by the Obama administration in front of the single payer movement. But single payer would also, I think, you know, some people may lose their jobs at work in the health insurance industries, but there's always we always need those paper pushers in all kinds of industries. And, you know, even still in the medical industry, we'll need those kind of people, you know, working with the government and stuff like that. But a lot of our car companies, our auto manufacturing companies are going out of business. And it's, you know, they need to, like, build more responsible product. But they also cite high health care costs for reasons why they're laying people off or moving their manufacturing out of the country.
No question. GM is the biggest insurance provider in the nation. You can almost call them more of an insurance health provider than a car maker. They spend so much money on that, and it's for not just their current employees but their past employees. So it's a very important role they play, and it's amazing how we're willing to, you know, respect the contracts for the bonuses of AIG, but not respect the contracts of the workers who are making the cars. It's just an incredible dichotomy between the, you know, the working class and the Wall Street class, and who Obama supports. But you know, on the single payer issue, I don't think it's dead at all. Jim McGovern, who has a single payer bill in the Congress, believes we will end up with single payer.
Is it different from John Conyers' single payer bill?
A little bit different from John Conyers. Conyers' bill has 75 co-sponsors. McGovern's has just a few. But the point is they both support single payer, and I think some of the difference are whether immigrants get coverage, that kind of stuff. But the Conyers bill, which is the more popular bill that's been around for a long time, been refined and refined and refined, has a provision in it that allows for a transition for the people who are currently in the insurance industry, where they get paid while they get retrained. And so they're aware of that issue, and they're trying to resolve it in a way that's positive. The California Nurses Association had some economists do some work and saw that the single payer actually creates more jobs than it loses. So, I'm not convinced the economics are bad that way, but the economics are certainly good for federal deficits, for Medicaid and Medicare. It will lower the cost of health care for the state governments as well. And it's also good for, big businesses of all sizes, small and large. It'll allow businesses to hire people without fear of the uncontrollable cost of health care, because that will be taken care of. It'll reduce the whole problem of malpractice, because if you have a bad health outcome, you will get health care to take care of that health outcome, so there'll be less need for malpractice lawsuits. It's a win-win-win-win on so many fronts. The only people losing are the health insurance and HMOs and pharmaceutical industries, and they have funded the President and the Congress to make sure that their interests are protected over the interests of everybody else. And so it's time for a populist revolt in this issue. And we got a very positive response to our action, not just from healthcare activists, but from Americans across the country. I think, and if you go to prosperityagenda.us, you can get involved in that ongoing effort. It's going to be ongoing. We're going to be trying to stop this health insurance bill and put in place a single-payer system.
Well, I always come down to the question is, how come Cuba can have universal health care? And, they might not be living high off the hog there, but, they are all entitled. Cuba thinks that it is a human right, not a privilege. And it seems like more in America, the robber class wants to convince us that it is a privilege. And, if you don't have health care and you get, you have to go to the emergency room, or and we know that bankruptcies because of, health or debt like that it's the number one cause for people to go bankrupt is medical issues. How come a country like Cuba can have it and we aren't entitled to universal health care here in America?
I think that you put it on the nail on the head there, where you said the bottom line is they see it as a human right and we see it as a privilege. And, the other difference is, of course, the capitalist economy versus the socialist economy. In our economy, the capitalists, the robber class, own the Congress. The root cause of our problem on almost every issue, as I said earlier, is corporate control of government. It's that link between corporations and government that's the root cause of so many of our problems, and healthcare is certainly at the top of that list.
Well, Dick Durbin said last week or the week before, I don't know, it's been so busy lately, that bankers still own Congress.
Bankers own Congress, and he said that when a very positive bill was defeated by a 55-45 vote. It was a bill that merely allowed a judge to restructure a mortgage so that people don't lose their houses when they go bankrupt.
Right.
The bank gets their mortgage payments, the people get to keep their house, the community doesn't have an abandoned house. It makes so much sense. But the bankers said no, and so the Senate, which is owned by the bankers, also said no.
Well, Kevin, I think that the answer, of course, has to be a populist revolt, and it has to be widespread and profound. And I think that, like you said, the tipping point has to be right around the corner. And just as what are we going to do? The reality that we're going to build out of the ashes of the U.S. empire, that's something that I always that I struggle with, because I have children and I have a grandson and another grandchild on the way. I think what we have to do is just do a real hard push education. We have to educate the American public about what's happening to them.
There's a lot of ignorance. There's no question about that. That is a big part of it. I think educate, organize, and activate are the three things we need to do, and education is a key first step. those that are educated are getting organized, and those that are organized are starting to agitate. And I think we need to be consistent and aggressive and persistent and not give up. You know, it's always hard to tell how close you are to victory. It's like you're pounding on a wall. You're chipping away at it, chipping away at it. You're not getting through it. The light's not coming through. And you say, God, I can't get through this wall. I'm breaking it, and I can't break it. And then you hit that last time, and it breaks through, and the wall was paper thin. At that moment, you didn't know. We don't know right now how thick the wall is. But I'll tell you, the U.S. economy is in a mess. Another economic collapse is not hard to imagine. The U.S. foreign policy is a mess. It's very expensive. It's counterproductive. The empire is crumbling. I see a lot of potential for some significant shifts, and the public is much more informed, much more active than people realize, and it does not take a majority to win. On every major change that we have seen in history, whether it's slavery, Jim Crow, women voting, union rights, ending the 40-hour work week, gay rights, you name it, it's not a majority that makes it happen. It's an agitated minority, organized and persistent. And that's what we need to develop.
Well, right on, Kevin. We've run out of time, and this has been a great conversation. How can people access the websites again? Say them one more
time. Well, the two major projects are VotersForPeace.us, which is the anti-war project, and ProsperityAgenda.us, which is the economic project.
Well, thanks for everything you're doing, Kevin, and hope
thanks
to talk to you soon.
All righty.
This is Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'll be doing my Soapbox rant.
This is Jamie Romano of James Communications. We are living in such exciting times. Never before in history has the global community come together in solidarity as we are now. Wonderful work is being done locally, nationally, and globally on every human and environmental issue that needs to be addressed. I developed James Communications to help you maximize your contribution to the world. Whether you're a small group, a large organization, or an individual with an altruistic dream, if you're working in service to humanity or the planet, James Communications will work with you to streamline efficiency and strengthen the impact of your cause or campaign. For more information on how James Communications can help you do what you do, please visit www.jamescommunications.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at cindysheehansoapbox.com. My soapbox rant today is called, "For Christ's Sake, Make Him Already." Quote, "You know, Mr. Randolph, I've heard everything you've said tonight, and I couldn't agree with you more. I agree with everything that you've said, including my capacity to be able to right many of these wrongs and to use my power and the bully pulpit. But I would ask one thing of you, Mr. Randolph, and that is to go out and make me do it." End quote. That was Franklin Delano Roosevelt to labor activist A. Philip Randolph. President Obama quoted this little vignette in history on several occasions. President Obama has told his followers if they want him to do anything, then they have to, quote, make him, end quote. How's that working out so far? The biggest rebellion against Obama from his supporters came during the campaign when he made it known that he would vote to authorize the Bush regime to spy on us and immunize telecom companies from releasing our phone records without warrants. The uprising was immediate and huge. The outcry was without teeth, though. Very few Obama voters threatened him with vote withholding. They wrote to him, blogged on his site, threatened to withhold donations, but nothing worked. He eventually did vote for the FISA Modernization Act against his supporters' wishes and against the will of his liberal base. Obama obviously did not care because he knew that these people would vote for him anyway and that Goldman Sachs et al. Would continue funding his campaign. Since he's been president, his behavior has been consistent with a tool of the empire, the military-industrial Wall Street robber class complex, and not with the will of the people. The most recent issue has been healthcare reform. I receive the most mail and requests to sign petitions and call Congress or the White House to make sure that single-payer healthcare or Medicare for All is on the table. This issue has been called the litmus test for the progressives on the Obama regime. Again, how's that working out for we the people so far? So far, Obama has again fallen in lockstep with corporations and has ensured that only health insurance companies, HMOs, and Big Pharma have a voice in healthcare reform, and the promise that he extracted from the health insurance companies is just another smokescreen to appease his gullible followers. He has flip-flopped on important issues like not releasing torture photos and reinstating military commissions after adamantly opposing military commissions during the campaign. I don't think Obama voters, in fact, I'm positive they do not, support torture or military commissions. But the silence from the left is certainly and crashingly deafening, as are the accolades about these policies from the right. On other issues, he is doing exactly as he promised, from the agonizingly slow and partial at best withdrawal in Iraq to surging against all reason troops and violence to what Obama and his war hawks call AFPAC, flying under the radar because of the they said, she said, he knew, she knew, they all knew torture brouhaha, is the fact that Congress passed another $94 billion funding package for Obama's so-called overseas contingency operations, which were called the Global War on Terror during the Bush administration. Also, the fact that his EPA, which stands for Environmental Protection Agency, what an Orwellian name, has approved 42 new sites for West Virginia mountaintop removal to extract coal. Obama loves to promote the myth of clean coal, which Robert Kennedy Jr. calls a dirty lie. The Sierra Club is rightfully distressed over this, but the group endorsed clean coal nuclear power supporting Obama during the election. What did the Sierra Club expect? Where is the outcry? Where were the protests demanding that Congress not fund Obama's occupations? Where are the huge marches protesting the occupations that regularly occurred during the Bush administration? Obama wants you to, quote, make him, end quote. His voters and supporters tried in vain to make him vote no on the FISA Modernization Act. Apparently, the attempt failed because they are only against warrantless wiretapping when Republicans are doing it and refuse to go the extra mile to withhold votes from the PINO, the progressive in name only. Single-payer advocates tried and it didn't work. The ACLU is trying, and so far, Obama's Department of Justice is blocking their efforts. Bush left office as the most unpopular president in American history. He wasn't only loathed by Democrats. Disgust with Bush ushered in this age of Obama. If you're not in an organized and persistent way taking up Obama's challenge of making him do the right thing, then one of three things may be happening. Number one, you think it will be a waste of time because you have seen that the pressure does not work. Or number two, you agree with his neocon and neoliberal planetary domination policies. Or three, you're only against violent suppression, oppression, and economic scandals and impoverishment when Republicans are in the Oval Office. Do not let the right accuse the left of hypocrisy. Let's show everyone that we are consistent with our integrity and progressive peaceful platform. Making him means having the integrity and courage that is so lacking in DC to withhold your support from someone who doesn't deserve it. Our Ask Cindy question today came from dozens of Soapbox supporters and listeners. Everybody wants to know how my son Andy is doing. If you're listening to the show, you probably know that my son Andy was in the hospital with a mystery disease for 11 days, and about 4.5 days he was in intensive care. Well, he got out of the hospital. He's at home recuperating. He's resting, taking it easy. It seems like his symptoms have abated, but the thing that distresses me and our family is they still don't know what's wrong with him. So they're still doing blood tests. They're trying to grow cultures to see what's wrong with him. And I want to thank you all for all of your alternative healthcare ideas. He is taking milk thistle and dandelion root on a daily basis to help cleanse his liver. He is taking probiotics to help recover from his illness that we really don't even know what he had, but he was on intensive antibiotic treatment. And this is what Kevin and I were talking about, healthcare. Every day, as a matter of fact, like every second Andy was in the hospital, I thanked the universe that he has good health insurance. He works for a union. He has great benefits. He's very fortunate. But that's not the case for 50 million Americans, including his mother. I don't know what I would do if something like that happened to me, except lay in my bed at home and try to get better without going to the doctor. And I am into alternative Eastern type treatment. I think that once in a while, Western medicine is important. And they did help Andy kick whatever he had. I just wish that they would help us know what he had in case it happens again. Kevin and I gave you many soapbox actions over the course of the interview. We hope that you go on to our website, Voters for Peace, and take the Voters for Peace pledge. This is Cindy Sheehan, Soapbox. We've come to the end of the show. I'd like to thank Kevin Zeese for being my guest, Scott Cuddy for being my engineer, Rich Bowser for being my webmaster, and you for being my listener. Please tune in next week, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. This is Cindy Sheehan, CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. Sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
get up now. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.